Well, in the last two messages, we have observed the life of Christ in the first few days of his ministry. And in today's message, we are in about day 12 of his ministry, so he has just barely begun. There were a few days from when he left Bethabara, where John was baptizing, where he got baptized as well, until he got to Cana. I believe he was in Cana likely for as long as 8 days. Jewish weddings would go from a few to 7 days in length, and gathering from the fact that they had run out of wine, and because of the amount of wine he made, I conclude it would have been a 7-day feast. And so our message, our last message in the Gospels, we gave considerations to Jesus' first miracle or sign, and it was a sign that he was and is truly the Messiah. If that is so, we now follow from Cana to Capernaum. Capernaum will be like Jesus' hometown from here on until he is crucified. And from Capernaum, he went on to Jerusalem, or he will go to Jerusalem. Jesus' mother and brothers have come with him from Cana to Capernaum. They spend several quiet days there, and so we turn to John chapter 2. And I want to read verse 12. After the Cana experience, it says, "After this he went down to Capernaum, he, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they did not stay there many days." So they spent a few days there, and then we find in verse 13 what happened. "Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." In my studies, Jesus makes 8 recorded trips to Jerusalem in his lifetime, but there may have been unrecorded trips there as well. His first trip to Jerusalem was for his naming and circumcision. His second trip was when he was 12 years old. This may have been his bar mitzvah, when he officially became a man. And you will remember how his parents left for Nazareth a day's journey before they found out that he was missing. And it says that they went back, that he went back with them to Nazareth, and there he became or was subject to his parents. That subjection may have lasted until he called his mother woman in our previous message. He has now just turned 30 years of age, and his ministry is now about 2 weeks old. And now, once more, he makes a trip to Jerusalem. But now, having taken on the office of the Messiah of Israel. So this is his first trip to the capital of Israel after his ministry has begun. And we are about to see the Messiah at work. Now, before we look at the rest of this chapter, let me make one more introductory point. Notice in verse 13 the reason Jesus, his mother and brothers, and his disciples go to Jerusalem at this time, that it is that the Passover is close at hand. 3 times in the year, at the 3 main festivals, all Jewish males were required to be present at Jerusalem. And Passover is one of those. And I have mentioned to you several times that I believe Jesus ministered for just over 2, not over 3 years. It could have been more, but it could not have been less than 2 years. The way scholars determine the duration of his ministry is by counting how many Passovers are recorded in the Gospels. I won't tell you more for now. Just keep in mind that we have the first one here. So having introduced this section of John 2, 12 through 25 by reading verses 12 through 13, we are now ready to look at what happened in Jerusalem. I have called this third main point in the gospel story the authentication of the Messiah to the world. And the third point in that section I have called his knowledge of the future. Only the Messiah could have known what we find that Jesus knew in this passage. And to that we want to give our attention for the rest of this time. Let's begin by looking at the cleansing of the temple in John chapter 2. John has already given to us some very important events in the life of Christ not recorded in the Synoptic Gospels, that is the other three, and here is another event that's only found in John. John does not give us information about the trip to Jerusalem or where they stayed night or any events that took place as they went. He just goes to the next event which he sees important for us to know. And just as we saw that Jesus qualified to be the Messiah by turning 120 gallons of water into the best grape juice you can get, we see here once more that he is the Messiah from his knowledge of the future. And so as we begin this point, let me give a little background information that will help put life into the event described by John the Apostle in these verses. I glean much of this from Alfred Edersheim. You see, we are close to the Passover, and before the three major feasts, preparations would begin about a month before the feast. And since it is Nisan, preparations would have begun in the month of Adar. All bridges and roads would have been repaired for the pilgrims. Their roads weren't like ours now. The paths, right? And they would travel on these repaired roads to Jerusalem to serve in the temple. That is the priests. The priests and the four groups of the Levites, those that served as priests, the musicians, the gatekeepers, the officers, the judges, would all travel to Jerusalem. During the other courses, only one course at a time traveled. During these feasts, they all traveled to Jerusalem, along with all the other Jewish men, and many of those men would have their families with them. So you can picture the roads busy with travelers on foot and by donkey. Many would choose this feast of the three to bring their tithes to Jerusalem. Money changers, of whom much might be said, would open their stalls in every town along the way, from Adar the 15th to the 25th. Many would be bringing sheep and doves to sell to those who sold these at the temple in Jerusalem, to travelers who could not bring their sacrifices as far as they would have to travel. The temple would be a hub of activity long before the feast, especially Passover. Inspections of sacrificial animals that would be sold to the travelers would have to be completed. Some of these, when they came before the priest for examination, would not be allowed, so they'd have to go buy another one. Those who examined the sacrifices for blemishes had been trained, and they charged certain fees for their checking and so on. There's no doubt that a lot of bad business was conducted on such feast days. Jewish men from other countries might have been relieved of a lot of money when they came before some of these money changers and those who sold sacrifices. Money changers would have their stalls set up at the temple. Edersheim says, and I quote, "Besides strictly Palestinian silver and especially copper coins, Persian, Tyrian, Syrian, Egyptian, Grecian, and Roman money circulated in the country," end quote. And so after the 25th of Adar, the money changers all moved shop to Jerusalem, to the temple, to gain as much as possible from this very lucrative business. To pay the right temple tax, many had to change their money, and for all of this, there was a charge. Edersheim thinks that all the money for the offerings, meat offerings, drink offerings, etc., all went through the hands of the money changers. You see, religious services would make a lot of money for those who could take advantage of it. And the Jews were not too far behind anybody else in taking advantage of such situations. Every proselyte, convert to Judaism, and every Jewish man would bring his temple tax, which had to be paid. That also went through their hands. And you can imagine with all the haggling over prices for the various sacrifices, offerings, and values of certain money, and bleating of the sheep, and lowing of oxen, that it was probably a noisy place around the temple. To top that off, the local priests of the line of Aaron, who had Annas as their high priest, this is the high priest when Jesus was crucified, he took advantage of all of this for his profit as well. The other priestly families did not share in that gain as much as the high priest. The high priest's office became one that garnered a lot of wealth. Edersheim says that Josephus and the rabbis paint a very dim picture of the priests and the high priest. Josephus called Annas a hoarder of money. This is all in the name of Jehovah, of course. It is into such an environment that the newly baptized Messiah, along with his mother, brothers, and newly gained disciples, make their way into the city of Jerusalem. But Jesus makes his way to the temple where his parents found him when he was 12 years old. So look at verse 14 now. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and money changers doing business. Here's the Messiah. He is creator of heaven and earth. He is the one who instructed David on how the temple was to be built and what sacrifices were appropriate and so on. And now he personally visits this place. I ask you, what is the proper response for one who is to return the people of God or people of Israel back to God? How should he have responded here? How should he have responded to this situation? Should he have dialogued? Should he have gone to the religious leaders and tried to persuade them to change their ways? Should he have sought out Annas, the high priest? After all, he was an authority over all of this. What would have been the right response of Jesus, the Messiah, in this very first case? Well, if we did not have the next verses, we would probably argue over this until kingdom come. And we probably still wouldn't agree. But I can tell you what the right thing would have been for him to do. I can tell you exactly how he should have responded, and I am certain of being 100% right. Look at verses 15 and 16. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, "Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise." You see, what Jesus should have done is he should have sat down and he should have made a whip and he should have gone and driven them all out of the temple. Isn't that right? That's what he should have done. If we didn't have this account, we probably wouldn't agree this morning. And he should have taken the tables that had all the money changers' money on, and he should have gone and tipped it up on the corner and let all the money roll down the floor. That's what he should have done. And he should have let them know exactly how outrageous their religiosity was. That is what he should have done, right? Right. You see, there was another day when Jesus spoke to the religious leaders. Do you know how he addressed them? Let me reduce it to how he began several of his addresses to the religious leaders. He said, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Woe to you, blind guides, fools, blind guides, blind Pharisee, serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the damnation of hell?" This is all in one account. Now, let me be quick to add that not all situations required a response like this. At the wedding at Cana, he graciously made a lot of pure, sweet grape juice for the occasion. But when the occasion called for it, he did what this passage tells us he did. I ask you, the Jesus you see in this passage, is he your Lord? Is this your Lord? Or is it the Jesus who only smiles and always unconditionally loves everybody? Which one is it? Another day, Jesus was in a synagogue, and there was a man with a withered hand. And the Jews were all waiting to see if he would have the audacity on the Sabbath to heal this man. They're just waiting to see. What's he going to do? What is he going to do? Go to Mark chapter 3. Let me read verses 1 through 6. Mark chapter 3. And he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand. So they watched him closely, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, now you see, what would be nice is to close the book and say, what would have been the right thing for Jesus to do? And discuss, what should he have done? Well, we have it in the account. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, step forward. Then he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they kept silent. And when he had looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him how they might destroy him. So verse 5 says, when he had looked around about him with anger, I ask you, is this the Jesus you know? I stress this point this morning because of our overemphasis today on the Jesus who loves and loves and loves and loves. Before we leave this subject, let me just mention that as I understand the Gospels, Jesus cleansed the temple 3 times. Some would hold that it was only twice. These are not big issues, but I feel it is 3 times. The first time was at the first Passover that Jesus attended after his ministry began, which we have here in John chapter 2. The second and third time were at the last Passover he attended just before he was crucified. So look now at verse 17. Back to John chapter 2. Then his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house has eaten me up. The online Bible says that this word zeal speaks of what it speaks of, and I quote, excitement of mind, ardor, fervor of spirit. Could I ask you this morning, is there any excitement of mind, ardor, or fervor of spirit in you when the things of the Lord are trampled down? Or do you sit by and just shake? Do you stand up for the truth or that which is right? Well, let's go on to a slightly different subject in verse 18. We look at it. So the Jews answered and said to him, what sign do you show to us since you do these things? So the Jews now request a sign. In a way, to me, it is surprising that they don't throw him out. But on the other hand, they have been caught with their hand in the cookie jar. They are guilty of wrongdoing. Jesus spoke with such authority that they must have wondered where he was from or whether he might be maybe a prophet of God. So they dare not throw him out yet, nor can they let this go without some challenge. So they want a sign of his authority. Nobody would dare to do something like this to their religious establishment of the day unless they had some authority. So they said, what sign do you show us since you do these things? So Jesus said something like this, a sign it is that you want. Well, let me give you a sign. Here it is. Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. So look at verse 20. 19 and 20, Jesus answered and said to them, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then the Jews said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple and you will raise it up in 3 days. So let me point out some important words here. If you are one of those that circles words and you make notes, here are some worth making. Look at chapter 2, verse 14. It says, "And he found in the temple." That word temple is the word hieron, H-I-E-R-O-N, hieron. Then in verse 15, "He drove them all out of the temple, hieron." But then look at verse 19 where Jesus said, "Destroy this temple." Now it is naos, N-A-O-S. And in verse 20, when they said it has taken 46 years to build this temple, the word they used was naos, and they were not technically correct in what they were saying. It was not actually the naos that was 46 years in building, it was the hieros. If there was one thing Herod was good at, and there was one he was good at, it was building. That man built incredible things. This temple, he's the one that did it. He's not even a bona fide Jew. And he built it for the Jews, seeking favor from the Jews. And he was rebuilding and beautifying it. And he had spent 46 years at it already, trying to gain favor with the Jews. Understand, it was still not completed. So look at verses 21 through 22. "But he was speaking of the temple, naos, of his body. Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said." That is after his resurrection. You see, at this first event, which is very obviously against the established religion of the day, Jesus knows that if he does what is right, if he does the truth, they will do away with him. He knows that. In this section where we have evidence given to us that Jesus was the Messiah, I've called this point evidence from his knowledge of the future. Who could tell you that I will die and be resurrected again in 3 days? Ellie Maxwell lamented that many leaders live too long. When you do the truth, when you do what is right, not only the world will hate you, but the religious leaders, the religious people of the world will hate you as well. That is clear from the life of Christ. The religious world will rise up against you. And even here, Jesus realizes that such actions as he has done here will end in his premature death. Listen, you have to understand, when you read these gospels and an account like this, he knows that if I do this, they're going to kill me. Many of us have, just in the last while, I have found it hard to stand with what for what I believe is the truth. When we know what it's going to cost us, we begin to shake. I know this. He knew, if I do this, this is what's going to happen. If I do what is right, if I do the truth, this is what is going to happen. It would be very interesting to take a passage like this to the religious leaders of our day without them knowing what the outcome was and say, what do you think would have been the right thing for Jesus to do? I dare tell you, they wouldn't have said this was the right thing to do. And yet he knows that though his actions will bring about his premature death, yet in the end, truth will triumph over evil. He knows this. You see, you can kill people, but in the end, you cannot overcome the truth. May that be an encouragement to everyone who stands for the truth. The Muslim world is killing off Christians because Christians are a threat to their way of life. But their religion is not the truth, and in the end, they will lose. All those who fight the truth will learn in the end that the truth alone is strong. And so we sing that great hymn once to every man, a nation, and it goes like this. Once to every man, a nation, comes the moment to decide. In the strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or evil side. Some great cause, some great decision, offering each the blight, bloom or blight, And the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness and that light. Then to side with truth is noble when we share her wretched crust. Ere before her cause bring fame and profit, and 'tis prosperous to be just. Then it is the brave man chooses, while the coward stands aside, till the multitude makes virtue of the faith they had denied. You must ponder these words. They are incredible. Though the cause of evil prosper, yet the truth alone is strong. Though her portion be the scaffold and on the throne be wrong, yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch above his own. Now in this passage, Jesus speaks of the Naos part of the temple. That is the part that took the place of the movable tabernacle they carried through the wilderness to Canaan. I have done some study on the Naos part of the temple, and what I have learned would take us a long time to consider, and I am sure I know but a small part of it. In this Naos part of the temple lies the secret of the makeup of the man, body, soul, and spirit, I believe. Herein lies a huge teaching of the temple in heaven, of which the one on earth was but a replica. I don't have time to tell you, but that's how I believe Old Testament saints could go to heaven and didn't have to go down to captivity because of this temple. Our bodies can be likened to the physical part of the Naos, that movable part. You know, see, it was called the tabernacle. It was the movable part. It says Jesus tabernacled among us. He had this Naos as well. So turn briefly to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. I want to just briefly show you a little bit of this. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. Do you not know that you are the temple, Naos, of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If anyone defiles the temple, Naos, of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, which temple, Naos, you are. Then look at chapter 6, verse 19. Or do you not know that your body is the temple, the Naos of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? Well, back to John chapter 2. Just 2 years later, at this same time, Jesus was apprehended, and they were seeking witnesses so that they would have ground to put him to death. Go to Mark 14. We just need to see a little bit of this. Mark chapter 14. And I want to read verses 55 through 59. Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands.' But not even then did their testimony agree." Oh, but when they later crucified him, they crucified him, and 3 days later, he fulfilled what he said here. Now listen, it shows us he is the Messiah. Who could prophesy this? No one. Okay, so I have named this passage as giving proof that he was the Messiah by his knowledge of the future, who could have prophesied his own death and resurrection, but the Messiah. Now the Passover feast is 8 days in length. The record of the event we have looked at happened on one of those days, but there were more. This feast begins with the Passover on the 14th of Nisan. On the 15th day, the Feast of Unleavened Bread begins. The 15th day was a special Sabbath. No matter which day of the week it occurred, it could occur on any day of the week, but that became a Sabbath, and it was a special Sabbath. And then 8 days later, they had another Sabbath, and it didn't matter what day of the week it occurred. It was a Sabbath as well. This is the Passover feast, all of this in between. So with that, look at verse 23 in John chapter 2. Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, that's what I explained, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. The Jews had asked for a sign so that they would know if he had the authority to do what he did in the temple. He did not perform a sign to prove his authority, but he told them in an interesting way about his death, burial, and resurrection. But after this, we find in verse 23 that he did other signs. Now listen, what we are reading this morning is not recorded in any of the other Gospels. That he did more miracles there is not recorded in any of them. John doesn't even record those other miracles, so we have no record of those signs. Now this word for signs is translated in the King James Version as miracles. That is the same word used for the event when Jesus turned the water into grape juice. Let me mention here as well that John will tell us in the last verse of this book that Jesus did many other things which he did not record. Can anybody tell me how many things did he say there were? When he said there were many other things there. How many were there? You know what he said? There were so many that if they were all written in books, you could not list them all. Now, you know, I think it's a hyperbole. It is an exaggeration for purpose of us understanding Jesus did a lot of other stuff we don't know anything about. Now notice that it says that many believed in his name. It seems to me that means they believed that he was the Messiah, but it does not mean that they had saving faith. Look at verses 24 through 25. But Jesus did not commit himself to them because he knew all men and had no need that anyone should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. This passage says that Jesus did not commit himself to those people because he knew all men. Yet among those men, all those men are some, like Nathanael, of whom Jesus said, anybody remember, what did he say? A man in whom there is no guile. There are some like that, though they are rare. Let me share with you what I have learned of mankind, and I know my understanding is very small. But when I was a young believer, I immediately sensed a call to work among our Mennonite people where I had grown up, or among whom I had grown up. And when I became a Christian, I saw how steeped in tradition we had become and that we had let the true faith drop. Many of you have discovered that. I learned from the catechism that somewhere in the past, we had had the truth and we had clearly taught it. And I enjoyed our people. I still do to a large extent. I still have no burden for anybody else like I do for our own people. So I was burdened for them, and I thought that if someone would just clearly explain the truth to them, they are such good people, they would want that, and they would gladly receive it. That's what I thought. It took me a long, long time to learn some very hard truths. I found that my own people are no different from any other people, nor any better. We have no greater interest in the truth than other people. And yet, as among all other people, there are some, praise God, there are some. That was true among the Jews in Jerusalem as well, as we will see in the next message. But there are not many. And that is why the scripture says, few will be saved. To be saved, you have to actually want the truth no matter what it will cost. Most people do not really want all the truth. They want the truth as long as it steps on somebody else's toes. As soon as it steps on mine, I'm no longer interested. And probably, the most disappointing truth I have learned is from my own heart. I want the truth. I have very carefully sought the truth. But in the midst of that, I have found that my own heart is very deceptive. I have come to learn, and I see it more, that in me, that is in my flesh, dwells no good thing. That is terribly disappointing. I can identify with these words of A.W. Tozer, who said, "I am not a good man. I am," this is what he said, "well, you'd have to use slang to describe me. By nature, I came that way, and when I saw it in my boys, I didn't blame them. I paddled them, but I didn't blame them. I can't go to God and say, 'God, I didn't do what that fella did. I've done everything either in actuality or in thought that could have been done. The devil himself couldn't have thought of anything that I haven't thought of in my lifetime.'" Now, that may be an exaggeration too. But he had been disappointed in himself too. To learn what is within man. I have come to experience just a little of what Jesus said when he said, "Blessed are those who mourn. I have not mourned over anything more than my own heart." I can understand what it means when Jesus said he did not commit himself to them. Because he knew what was in man. My greatest amazement now, in older days, is in the fact that when we learn how we really are inside and mourn about that, then we become those whom God can use. There is no other way. So it says in our text, "But Jesus did not commit himself to them because he knew all men and had no need that anyone should testify of man, for he knew what was in man." And I want to tell you that the only hope for us is when we learn what is truly in us. And when we truly learn what is in us, it is not pleasant. And so we conclude this morning in the book of John. We have now seen his first miracle, his first confrontation with the religious Jew of his day. You can imagine if Jesus came on the scene today and the very first church he went to, he did something like this. Can you imagine what it would be like? What kind of criticism do you think would be labeled against him in our day? What would we think of his tact? Would we not expect him to dialogue with the religious leaders and try to politely and tactfully explain that you don't do things like this? Would we not have expected him to tactfully try to bring them all on board? Would we not expect him to find the areas of agreement and center on those? That's what's happening between evangelicals and Catholics today. Evangelicals and Mormons today. I think we would view something like this as a bull in a china shop. And we must ask ourselves, did he do the right thing by walking in there with a whip? What kind of talk do you think buzzed around in Jerusalem that day and likely throughout the days of that Passover? How do you think Jesus was viewed by the Jews after this first day in Jerusalem? I would like to leave that question for you to think about for this coming week. If Jesus did something like this, how must he have been viewed by the people in that day? Well, may the Lord bless. May the Lord teach us out of this for his glory.